Good evening and welcome to the second forum this week around the question, can there be a Christian soldier? Which is really a question which ought to lead us to explore, I think, very broadly, as Larry Rasmussen suggested, the whole relationship between Christianity and military service. My name is Mark Schwain, and I'm the village philosopher. And I must tell you that I'm especially looking forward to tonight's forum for a personal reason, and that is that I think that of all questions, this one is one that in my own mind I'm quite divided about and quite and very much struggling with. And therefore, your comments and our collective exploration of the issue will be very personally meaningful to me. What I thought I might do is to simply start out and, in very brief form, simply recount to you what it is that makes me struggle so with the question and why it is that I'm not as clear in my own mind about it as I'd like to be. On the one side, that is the side of me that suggests that military service is perfectly consistent with Christianity. I guess there's the whole experience I've had teaching history, and when I teach the American Revolution or French Revolution, any number of other armed conflicts that I won't itemize, there's a sense in which I really do feel that certain important historical changes and salutary historical changes sometimes emerge from those conflicts. And I admit, since I guess I ought to confess everything, that when I hear Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, for example, consecrating the battleground at Gettysburg, there is a part of me that feels a genuine sort of clutch at the throat, a clutch that comes, I think, from the sense that there was a certain kind of freedom achieved for a large body of Americans out of that conflict. Some of the people who I consider great heroes of faith, Dietrich Bonhoeffer among them, his book, Cost of Discipleship, has been deeply important to me. Nonetheless, found himself in a situation where he became involved quite willingly and extensively in an extraordinary conspiracy aimed toward taking the life of Adolf Hitler. And I guess there's a part of me that feels that that was deeply courageous and extraordinary, and I want to affirm that. And furthermore, from a deeply personal standpoint, I guess I feel that somehow a lot of the things that I enjoy, like political liberty and so on, has been, in a sense, and I underscore the word somehow, the result of other human beings who have died for certain of those beliefs. So there's that whole side of me, which is a very powerful side and accounts for one half of the struggle. The other half of the struggle has the same kinds of considerations, though, and that is historical ones and religious ones and personal ones, and goes something like this very quickly. I was very moved by this evening's Vespers and by the fact that tomorrow will be the commemoration of Hiroshima. And in thinking about that event historically, I've come to learn that those people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in a sense, died for reasons that are much more complicated than the ones that most of us think. Namely, we mostly think, I think, that they died in order to save American lives, which is what President Truman gave as his reason for authorizing their use, and for ending the war. I've discovered in studying that our own strategic bombing survey went in there after the war was over, and after mountains of paper wound up concluding that the war against Japan would have ended, Japan would have surrendered, no later than September 1st, even if we hadn't used atomic weapons, even if Russia hadn't entered the war, even if we had suspended the firebombings of Tokyo. And one historian who's written a fairly recent book on that particular historical event winds up concluding that the casualties at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not the last casualties of World War II, but were the first casualties of the Cold War. What all that means simply to me is that the lessons of history are at best obscure on this subject and lead to further confusion. As far as the next point, sort of theologically, I guess the kinds of people who you will see if you see the movie later this week, Excuse Me, America, and I urge you all to see it, because if you want to see, actually see, in an empirical way, the faith to go out with good courage, you can look at some of their faces and actually see that virtue written there. And I suppose those kinds of people, particularly Dorothy Day, Sister Mary Teresa, others I could name, Gandhi and King, who are not in that film, have taught me to understand the kind of force and the kind of courage through a definite kind of action, a nonviolent sort, that is world-changing, and that somehow to me, as I think about the Gospels, is much more in consonant with the way I read them than is military action. The bottom line for me, I think, is that my wavering is in large part due maybe to the fact that I just don't quite have enough faith, which means that I don't quite have the kinds of courage that it takes to engage in that kind of action as yet. I want to let God be God, but I often want to let him be God most of the time, and some of the time would like to take matters into my own hands. And as far as courage is concerned, which comes from that kind of faith, I guess I find myself wanting to hold on to something and keep things kind of in my own control and endorse military solutions under certain circumstances and can't go all the way with the second position which I'm tending toward. So that pretty well, I think, sets up how my own mind is divided about it and haven't made it up yet. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on the relationship now between Christianity and...
One thing I thought, when I heard the title, I thought maybe we ought to preface the evening by saying that unless we're about the business tonight of judging who is a Christian and who is not a Christian, why don't we begin the evening by saying, yes, good Christians have been soldiers in good faith, who were trying, who sinned boldly, made the move they could, and did what they could. And so we can say, yes, good Christians have been soldiers, and now talk about the questions Christians face, as you synopsize well.
I appreciate that word. I meant to say it myself, because we're not in the business of making that kind of judgment, and it seems to me what you said is exactly right. Thank you.
What are your conclusions then about the bombing of Hiroshima, or your personal? What's your the premise of your feelings of the bombing of Hiroshima?
I'm going to lead a discussion tomorrow during the first interrupt on the history of that decision, in which I would be more elaborate about it. My own views, in brief, is that it was a decision which was a great tragedy, and we shouldn't have used those nuclear weapons, that we didn't, as a matter of fact, save very many American lives, and that it was just a colossal tragedy. That's, in a nutshell, my conclusions, but the whole reasons for that, I think I'd rather go into tomorrow at 5.
In the field of medicine, we often find that a person has died, and in reviewing the case after the autopsy is done, you find that the patient might have been saved had you done something differently. and we often call that the retrospectoscope. And I wonder if you're perhaps not doing the same thing when you begin to draw your own conclusions with regards to the bombing of Hiroshima. The leaders of the country and the military men at that time had to make decisions using the best information that they had available at that time. Now, unless you accuse them of making a capricious decision of bombing Hiroshima just to see if the bomb worked, I think it may be a mistake to look with the benefit of 30 years of history and make conclusions with regards to the bombing of Hiroshima. I think the statement that was just made, that there have been good Christian soldiers, might even be made with regards to President Truman and some of the military men that helped to make that decision. It's a, nobody likes the results of what happened at Hiroshima, but a great war was being fought and American lives were being lost.
But even medicine, medical people wouldn't do autopsies if they didn't believe they could learn something from the retrospective point of view. So at this point anyway, it seems like what we can learn from looking back after years on that, the historians looking at it and reevaluating it, will give us something for facing the future, which I think is, at least during this forum, more at hand. Retrospection has kind of a bad name put on it, but without it, we're doomed to repeat ourselves or whatever.
Certainly it can be useful, but to condemn what happened, that's not to say we can't learn for the future. Hopefully we will be able to learn for the future. But to say what happened in the past was an altogether bad event, maybe to unjustly criticize the people involved.
John, will you?
Yeah, I appreciated the first comment about the theme, and if we can kind of assume that we are recognizing that. I was happy with the theme, even though I had a similar response. First, I thought we'd vote yes or no, and we could be done. Any theme that is a question that you can answer yes or no. I'm happy that it specifically asks for the Christian response to an issue. Very frankly, my biggest frustration, disappointment. My biggest disappointment is forums at Holden are much too similar to forums not at a Christian lay theological reflection center. In regard, controversy doesn't bother me at all. Very rarely do I find at the forums at Holden that we're asking, what does faithfulness to Jesus Christ, specifically, what does a biblical consciousness mean in a particular ethical situation? I've been here 3 years. You will find that we'll begin to talk what's effective, you'll begin to talk what's pragmatic, we will begin to talk what's reasonable, we'll begin to talk what's loyal to the United States, we'll begin to talk what will work, you will be called naive or realistic. All of those terms are legitimate terms for a discussion among people. Very rarely do we say, what did it mean to be followers of the way? What does it mean to have the scandal of the cross? And I think that's a legitimate forum. In fact, I don't think we can ask the foreign policy of the United States to be a biblical understanding of our discipleship. In other words, I'd be less interested tonight in Harry Truman or Hiroshima as I am what faithfulness to me means. Reinhold Niebuhr wrote a pamphlet, a very good article, on why the Christian is not a pacifist. When John Howard Yoder sat in that chair and laid out his understanding as a Mennonite, and there really are only three well-known peace churches, Mennonite, Brethren, Quaker, so that the answer, Christians are not soldiers, is by a very small minority, and probably no one here is from one of those groups. If you're Roman Catholic, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, you primarily are in a tradition of justifiable war.
But when he laid out his understanding of what it meant to be followers of the way, it was a very fine presentation of faithfulness to Jesus Christ and a very convincing kind of second half of what you did. Someone from the balcony mentioned Reinhold Niebuhr's Why the Christian is Not a Pacifist. Yoder, you'd have to know him because it sounds smart aleck and facetious, and that's not Yoder. He said, that is an excellent piece. I don't know of anything more logical or consistent or well-written. You have in that document all of the best reasons for not following Jesus. And I think that's a legitimate response. I really think the first 300 years of history, the answer was a fairly universal one of Christians are not participants in military action. In fairness to that history, if you read the early church fathers, there was more worry about them being guilty of idolatry in the army than there was the issue of violence. Sometimes people who are coming from the pacifist tradition don't mention that. My understanding is there was a year, 2 years kind of trial period. If someone had been in the military, wanted to come back in the Christian community and take the Eucharist again, there was a long kind of, well, not becoming worthy again, but testing the commitment. It seems to me very heavy evidence, if you study the New Testament, that followers of the way, first name for those who follow Jesus, was a pervasive nonviolence and a forgiveness of the enemy and a willingness to die. It was not a way to retreat or to save your own neck, a willingness to die rather than to take up arms. And I really am going to, tonight, since you gave that title, going to keep us to a biblical understanding of faithfulness to Jesus Christ in that personal struggle.
Good. Other responses?
Was part of that due to the fact that if you became a soldier, then you would show allegiance to the emperor, as opposed to allegiance to Christ? Is that the...
When I said that there was as much talk or more in the church fathers about idolatry, Caesar is Lord instead of Jesus is Lord, that was talked about as much as the fact of violence or whether or not a Christian ever could take up arms. In other words, the idolatry decision was. But even with Bonhoeffer, he called himself a pacifist, considered himself a pacifist. You said, I forget what word, I would say he very reluctantly was part of the assassination plot, meaning he considered it sin and not following Jesus, but he also considered that there is no unambiguous place to stand. And confessing his failure to follow Jesus at a point in the business of getting the mad driver out of the stagecoach, at some point you have to get the driver out. You can't keep picking up the people. And he's running over. He didn't justify that from his Christian faith. He felt that he could be forgiven. It's almost as though you could almost in a prejudiced way say tonight, is it possible to be a Christian and sin? Sure. That is a prejudiced way to state it. But yeah. The song, "You Want My Land? I Understand. Just Don't Blame God." And Bonhoeffer did not do that in the assassination plot. Larry's written a book on him, so I shouldn't talk about Bonhoeffer and whether or not he...
Yes.
I'm Lutheran and have been all my life, but because my parents were teachers and taught in a Mennonite colony in southern Minnesota, I grew up and went to the Mennonite church. Probably because the Lutheran church on the edge of town is of a different set of women. Secondly, because I'm Haugi Synod, and the pastor recommended the Mennonite church all the way over. It was transferred from. But I did, all of my friends were Mennonites, the Sunday school, the church service, confirmation, all of this I've been through in the Mennonite church, and The answer, I think, that my friends there during World War II would give, and I don't mean to cut off discussion, but hopefully to provoke it, would be that there are simply some things, as a Christian, one cannot do, no matter how much good results from it, or how necessary it is. And to take another human life under any circumstance is simply one of those. I was impressed during the orientation session by Mary's statements about how free Holden is. You can do this, you can do anything you want, but there are some things we will not discuss. This is what you must do. And in a sense, the Mennonite friends that I knew, and a part of me that I suppose has become Mennonite, would say the same thing. So that you can say, yes, the war ended more quickly. Yes, this had to be done, and so forth. That's simply not discussable.
I think that this whole question that you brought up about the meaning of which I'm glad you did, because I hoped that would be the central focus of the forum. And my introduction of history, which I don't think we should pursue, not only for the reason that I want to keep it focused where you do, but because somehow my understanding, as I'm groping toward it, for what it means to follow Jesus, is precisely not that you worry about being on the right side of history or making history come out all right. That somehow, that being faithful means to be faithful to the way and not to figure out a kind of pragmatic or realistic or historical or intellectual or any word you want to put in there terms of exactly how to make history come out the way you think it would be best to come out. In other words, justifications for A, B, or C on those grounds are simply interesting, but they're not Christian grounds, it seems to me.
I want to stay on the line that John has commended to us, but I want to go back to Hiroshima and ask whether there is a kind of threshold that was passed in Christian thinking about war and peace with nuclear weapons, and not simply nuclear weapons, but any weapons of just utterly massive destruction, such as many non-nuclear weapons are now. In fact, we were at a briefing at the Pentagon in a class earlier this in the spring semester, and the briefing officer told us of a couple lines of weapons which fall under what are called conventional weapons, but which are more destructive than nuclear. Anyway, the long tradition of thinking, Christian thinking on war and peace has been, as John mentioned, a pacifist tradition, which has been a minority position at least since Constantine, and a justified war position. Both of them start out with a very strong conviction that participation in war is an evil, but there may, in some circumstances, the justified war tradition says, be an exception to that, where it's a lesser evil to participate in the use of killing violence than not to do so. It is, in any case, a sin and a great evil. But that tradition of justified war was one which assumed that you could make a meaningful distinction between combatants and non-combatants. There was a notion that some peoples are at least relatively so, innocent, whether it's portions of the population, children, the elderly, people who are not participating in a direct way in the war effort. And one of the criteria of the justified war tradition in Christian thinking is the war one which is asking you to kill non-combatants or innocent portions of the population. And I think it's a serious question now, with weapons of massive destruction, whether the justified war tradition in Christian thinking has been rendered obsolete by the technology that we employ in war. When at Hiroshima, there was no distinction made between young and old, babies and grandparents, soldiers and civilians, when all of that was simply put in place by the boards in total destruction, then do you have the kind of peace, war, a situation where it's meaningful to talk about an alternative other than the pacifist one. Well, there may still be situations. I can think of blacks in South Africa and talking about justified revolution where you don't have, where it still may want to employ that tradition. But I really have to ask whether what some people call nuclear pacifism isn't the present continuation, if you will, of the justified war line of thinking. And that's just an observation.
John, Mark, really, I would say one thing and ask one question. I'd say to John, it's exciting to me to hear you say what you say about the forum at Holden really constantly keeping in the forefront the question of the impact on the Christian. Where do we stand? What is it that the Way tells us about this? Because those of us who have participated in lots of public meetings or forums elsewhere find out how often they deteriorate or move to the first point to which you made reference. The question with the gospel on the side somewhere and merely talking about, if you will, the practicalities or the politics or the economics or the social factors or what you will. So I'm excited about that being kept in the forefront of this. It would be helpful, ultimately, at least from my perspective, if also we kept in perspective here, or at least ended up by saying, and then what do we as Christians do about this? This nation is involved in a situation where we're spending the astronomical figure that's going to be dealt with tomorrow night on armaments. What then does the Christian say ought to happen in that situation? Go to zero? Is there a road in between somewhere? Larry's thought is titillating, so far as I'm concerned. Is there a middle road somewhere? Is there any justification for us keeping a military existence in the United States as a peacekeeping force? And what does that mean if we keep it as a peacekeeping force? Then we merely keep it there, but if the chips are ever down, we really don't use it. And if we are ready to use it, then are we embarking on the road by spending money for it that is antithetical to our faith? So, without rambling along those, but the ultimate question is, and then what do we do about it? If we are committed in our faith as citizens, as members of the community, as voters, as office holders, what does it mean to do?
I hope that, or I'm glad that at least there's the possibility that there are still two sides, or I guess in my mind there still are, and I guess I share some of your questions and frustrations, and I guess I have to admit that I don't either have a clear statement or decision in my own mind of where I can really take this statement. I think it's difficult because of partially out of tradition where we come, where we, again, as you say, respected people that have been in the military. I realize that there's been freedom fought for, others have killed for our freedom. All these things to me make it very difficult, and again, it's just personal, and I guess that's the one thing that I want to try to say is that I still feel that there's something very personal about that decision, where it would hurt me greatly, I guess, if at this point, or even the church would say that there is no choice. In some ways, maybe they're doing that, and maybe that's what we ultimately have to come up with, that love should conquer all. That's the ultimate. maybe that's the point where we really come down to saying that pacifism is the only way. And maybe at some point in my life that I'll get there too. I'm not there yet. I guess I like Bonhoeffer from the standpoint that I respect him as a Christian, and I think most people do, and yet he made a tough choice that wasn't pacifism. It involved killing, working for a military machine in a sense. He made a decision that, I don't know. You know, he says that he did it, he knew he was sinning, and yet he did it. And I think that's where in a sense we have to come from too, that we should have that free choice of making the decision, even if it's to sin, if it's our conviction at that point that the Lord is leading us into that area. I would hope that we would have, again, the encouragement of other Christians to sin boldly at that point. Part of the tragedy of Hiroshima for me, and it just, I guess, occurred or reoccurred tonight, was that in almost, well, I guess 35 years since that time, that maybe the division has become greater between those who are against the military machine and those who are for it. Rather than, at that point, people who are now making the military decisions were 20 years old at that time. If the church really proclaimed, you know, love, rather than carrying on a fight or carrying on a divisiveness, that maybe those people who were 20 years old at that time would now be the pacifists that, you know, could have made that change in 35 years rather than things getting worse. Even in the church where there's a possibility where there's funding being made for dealing with conscientious objectors, but if I was the age where I had to make that decision again, would I get counseling if I decided to go into the military? You know, how I could dealing with the sinful nature that I have that allows me to make that decision. I'm not sure. You know, is there a choice? Is it a free choice? How can the church help in that choice?
First back over here.
I guess I have two comments. First, I worry a little bit when we tend to look at the early church, and maybe sometimes we idealize it or think that that was where Christianity was at its purest. And I don't think we can definitely learn from the early church, but never think that they had it all together there, and we might not. And then second, I guess I've struggled, I guess that's maybe a cheapened word nowadays, but struggled with the idea of pacifism during the summer. I still can't bring myself to the idea that we as Christians aren't called to be effective. It seems like we are in the world and we are called to be effective in the world, to make the world as good as it can be. And part of that, I think in some cases, it's definitely been misused many times, means that, like you say, there are some occasions where war can bring about benefits. And I think we have, as Christians, we have to think about effectiveness to some extent in the world, and sometimes war is effective, and pacifism is not.
Yes.
It seems to me that it kind of begs the question to talk in terms of Bonhoeffer's doing away with Hitler, who had, at the time the plot was hatched, already been responsible for the deaths of somewhere between 6 and 8 million people. And you and I taking a gun and shooting some other citizen who's a relatively innocent citizen who's been brought into this political confrontation for some reason or other, probably doesn't have any more conviction about his willingness to shoot you or I or to die for his country than we were. For just a moment, I would like to explore, I don't think that many of us would argue that whatever we have pursued for the last 70 years has been successful, because all we've done is bring the world time and time and time again to the armed confrontation. What would happen if
the pacifists actually became the majority in this country, and perhaps even in the world. It's a risk, certainly. There's no question about that. It would be a risk if the vast majority of Americans said, no, we won't go. There's no question about that. But on the other hand, would it be any greater risk than saying, yes, we're ready, and start pushing the buttons? Because in either way, there's a tremendous risk, it seems to me, and wouldn't it be refreshing to try something new and different?
Mark, you got some
questions? Over here. Yes, you, sir.
Oh, thank you. My wife and I often talk about our children, and I look in the balcony tonight and see these young faces, and we ask ourselves the question, why do we have children? It's a good question for a Christian family to ask themselves. What is the reason for having children? And an answer that both of us have concluded is to perpetuate Christianity, Christ's kingdom here on earth. Because when we're gone, our children and our grandchildren and our grandchildren's children, that we will be able to perpetuate his kingdom. I then think of, say, Portland, Oregon, becoming a stage that happened in China, where the so-called communists took many of the missionaries and put them on greased poles and shoved their rectums over these greased poles. I think then of that happening to my children or my grandchildren, and I say to myself, I don't have a choice if that should happen, or if there was a possibility that it would happen to them. I would know that the decision would be to counteract that type of evil. I may have to kill someone to do it, but to perpetuate Christ's kingdom here on earth, many times we're called upon to do things that we question, but it's like I was reading last night in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. There's no end to conversation. There's no end to the writing of books and to ideas. But the love of God is what is important. Now, just from the standpoint of our family and the way that just one person in this room thinks, and I only have one vote, I understand that, but I'm quite strong in my belief that we must stand up for what we feel as Christians is right, to perpetuate Christ's kingdom here on earth, not in a fanatical way. Not to just say, well, let's kill the communists. That isn't the answer. I heard a story, and I'll finalize it, just tonight for the first time, that my wife's brother was on the battlefield, and he laid down his gun because he saw a German soldier that had been shot, and he was going to help him. And as he was helping him, the soldier evidently came to a little bit, grabbed his gun, and shot Jane's brother. Well, there really are some things that there are no answers to, other than to try and do what God would want us to do. And that's a hard question to answer to. Just some food and reflection for thought.
Yes, ma'am.
What this gentleman said about what communists...
Some
communists have done. I'd say, for one thing, that the United States, our military schools have trained Latin American military personnel to do exactly the same type of thing that you just described communists do. They've taught Iranians under the Shah to do the same kind of thing. We have trained people in torture. We have not been clean in that ourselves, nor is our military operation. It sounds to me like the point at which your wife's brother was shot, he died in much the same type of way that Jesus died on the cross. More willing to lay down violence in order to love someone and treat them as a human being, taking the full price of that upon himself. That's a beautiful story.
But it didn't end.
It didn't end that beautiful.
He didn't tell you the end. My brother picked up his bayonet and killed the other man, even though he was wounded. And he became a very bitter individual because of that for quite a few years. So that wasn't the end of the story. That has been finished.
Well, of course, that's the trouble with killing each other.
Right.
There's no end, and I'm all for what this gentleman had to say here. John, I believe your name is. I go along with that all the way. I cannot see that taking another life for any reason is going to benefit anybody. Surely not my children.
Yes, but what happens if your child or your grandchild is killed? Then it doesn't make any difference.
No, it doesn't.
That is exactly the question that I used to beat my MMA friends with. You know, what if they're coming right down the street to your house?
Right.
And their answer, and a part of me wants to answer that too, is that this is God's world. God is the person who is effective. He will, and you have to absolutely trust, radically trust, that he will make things come out right. On the other hand, the Lutheran part of me agrees with the confusions that many of the rest of you share, and that is that God invites us and demands us to participate in history, and that some of it is up to us. And so the Lutheran part of me is the part that has to make those kinds of decisions, in which occasionally it may be even necessary to sin boldly. But I don't think that my Mennonite friends would agree that it's ever necessary to sin boldly. You are in God's hands, and that, and participation in history in that way. And so for them, it was a kind of silly question, what would you do if they're coming down toward your children? You know, if you really believe that you're in God's hands, it may be that your children will be killed, but somehow it will come out right. At least it isn't going to be made right by you responding with violence, to violence done.
Mm-hmm. Ricky?
We're talking about financial reform. I guess I don't understand why, at least in a situation like that, to kill is a greater sin than to allow people to be killed. You know, if he had the choice of either, you know, not acting or acting, why would that be a sin? You said that was considered, that he considered it a sin to engage in a military plot, right? But that he was going to do it anyway. But then why isn't it sinful? Isn't it a greater sin to sit by and watch people being murdered?
That's what Larry used as our justification. And that's what I meant when I said no unambiguous place to stand. There is no pure place, guiltless, unambiguous, have all the Bible on your side in the spectrum of issues. But he didn't justify as faithfulness to Jesus Christ called me to kill Hitler. He never said that, as though that was the pure side. If you're saying the other side also, seeing 6-8 million people exterminated was also sin, yes, that's why he made his move. He was using a kind of lesser of two evils argument, I think. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but then
lesser of two evils, one of them would not become a good. It's a lesser of two evils.
Right, but then is pure pacifism then simply the lesser of two evils? Or is it truly the way of Jesus? Because I think you were saying that that is the way of Jesus, but in that case, it's simply the lesser of two evils. It's not, you know,
couldn't he have done other than to stand by? That we always put it in two extremes, that you either act violently or you do nothing. What about active nonviolent resistance? There's a kind of guts that it takes to stand in opposition to evil, where you go out without weapons in the way that Gandhi led Indians to resist the British, where you know you're laying your life on the line. It's not in any kind of secretive plot, and you don't have a gun in your hand. There's a third response.
The Jews were nonviolent to the point of 6 million people.
Yeah, how offensive is nonviolence? That would be my question.
So if we all accept what we know that the Bible has said about nonviolence and not killing people, we can stop this whole forum. We all know what it has said, and if we limit ourselves to the formal Christian position on what should happen, we can stop the whole discussion. But
you missed my whole point. Mm-hmm. You missed the whole thing. The New Testament called some people to be followers of the way, a very small number. You look at how many Jesus said, follow me, and how many he said, go back to your own land. He even wondered if there'd be any faithful when he returned. All of our visions have the Constantinian compromise of assuming we're talking about how a Christian nation acts. That's not the New Testament. It's not the premise of what it meant to be a follower of Jesus. They understood followers of the way at a time when that meant being wrapped in an animal skin, thrown for the amusement of Caesar, dipped in pitch and put up on a pole and burned, and they were still nonviolent. If you say it would be simple if we could all be like the early Christian church, I'm talking in the midst of absolute violence, of a very good chance that not only our grandchildren didn't live, but you and I didn't live. They understood faithfulness to Jesus Christ to be nonviolent and martyrdom. We wouldn't have a church. There wouldn't have been a power of the Holy Spirit if they had not understood nonviolence. I'm trying to say that's our history. Now, Mark says he's not real interested in early Christian history. I'm very interested in the hermeneutics, meaning what did the earliest group understand as what it meant to be followers of the way? What did the first hearers hear? And for 300 years, how did they understand that? Yes, I want to be in that tradition. All of the arguments about that not being effective or anything else, perfectly all right for a forum. What we usually miss is what is the radical nature of the call of the New Testament. And I'm simply saying, if you take every time the New Testament says, be like this, have the mind of Christ, be imitators, it's always at the point of servanthood, which replaces domination, and forgiveness that absorbs hostility. That's the only time the New Testament says, now this is where you should imitate Christ. And I think we lose that. You can convince me that that's naive, and the world standards. You can say, how often does nonviolence work? It didn't work for Jesus. Yeah, and Dan Berrigan gave a talk. Just a minute. I'll let you come back. It's a forum. Dan Berrigan gave a talk, and the whole group responded like people usually respond. Do you know what would happen if I started down that road? You priests are so naive. I'm a businessman. I can't live that way. Father Berrigan said, my goodness, I guess I should have had a prelude to my talk. I assumed we all knew it. Before you start down the road of being a Christian, that's the title, before we start down that road, make sure you look good on wood. That's the whole Don't we know that? What do we come through with year after year after year? And it's always a scandal when you lay out what it means to be a follower of Christ. That's all I was saying. I mean, people assume when I say that I've got that all straight. that I think it's easy, that I live that way. No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying, if you go back with a biblical consciousness of what it means to be a Christian, it is a very, very scandalous nonviolence in the midst of a violent world, in the midst of a very violent world. That's what I mean. No.
Do I hear you promoting a dichotomy among Christians then, that there are those of us who should strictly and faithfully follow the words of Christ and the Old Testament, and then there are those of us who can be partially Christians and then go on and make our rules to suit us as we go along?
I don't know of any Christian group that's not stating that what they want is to be faithful to what it meant to be Christian, faithful to the Old and New Testament. And I'm saying that's always the point of a Christian theological discussion, and that's our point tonight. And when you come to what I think is a biblical understanding of what faithfulness to Jesus means, we too often have criteria of good morals, of Victorian ethics, of shape up in regard to sex. Sometimes it's been no smoking, no alcohol, lots of things, instead of what I think is a much heavier biblical emphasis in this question than in a lot of our other moral questions. When we ask, I think all of us are asking, what does faithfulness to Jesus Christ mean? I'm not saying everybody here is professing to be a Christian. All of us who are professing to be Christians, I think, are asking that question. We're not asking for a dichotomy between those who are halfway and those who are all the way, are we? I mean, I'm not trying to divide. I maybe you misunderstood one of the things I said, and that may be my fault. I'm saying followers of the way in the New Testament, as I understand it, is very different from a somewhat Christian culture that makes decisions in the Defense Department about the foreign policy and the military budget of the United States. I don't think the New Testament has as much to say. I think we ought to get back, what does this mean for us? Don't misunderstand me. But I don't think the New Testament has as much ethics for a somewhat predominant Christian culture as a nation as it does for what it means to be followers of the way. And that's the ecclesia, that's the called out who are faithful to Jesus Christ, who have their, that's their first loyalty. My first loyalty is not the United States. Bill Stringfellow said, until you know that this is also Babylon, you will never be faithful to Jesus Christ. I think that's good theology. I don't think that's treason. I'm very happy that this is the Babylon I live in. There's no place in the world that probably gives me as much freedom to say that tonight here without being zapped. And I'm very grateful for that. But it is Babylon.
There is no room for discussion. Is that what you're saying?
No, all kinds of room for discussion. What do you mean?
I just found myself being confused by...
I feel, John, like you're trying to create a Christian utopia that's not possible to create.
That's what I hear.
Meaning that Christ himself wasn't able to fulfill it, but left us with... Well, okay, to complete my mission, because he was, for one reason or another, maybe God's will, that it was not possible for Christ to finish his work here on earth, therefore we are to finish it, and yet it's not possible for us to finish it because we're not God. Therefore, at one point in someone's life, it will be finished, in whatever tone that happens to leave us in. But meaning that the Christian utopia, I think the thrust in my mind is that is not possible.
I don't mean this to be me against the it seems to me that for me to think the highest call upon my life is faithfulness to Jesus Christ, again, don't misunderstand, as though I'm pulling that off well or what have you. the opposite of utopia, meaning I'm asked to make history come out right or determine the shape of this world and who should get killed and who shouldn't, if my understanding is faithfulness to Jesus Christ and there's still a Lord of history, that Jesus did bring a kingdom, and I think he did, that kingdom is here and it's characterized by the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes that we read about. Do you mourn now? Good for you. That's what the kingdom is about. Are you poor? Good for you. It's for poor folk. I believe that kingdom is a reality. That's not utopian. That's the most realistic understanding of that in this world, you do not, Reinhold Niebuhr even had the irony of history. If we'd all decide how history should come out and have the money and the bombs to do it, the irony of history is we would probably fail. Time after time it would fail. For me to be relieved of the burden of creating utopia, seek to be faithful to Jesus Christ as I understand it, is the most freeing gospel I can imagine.
Yeah, that's true. And I think we all Christians seek that goal. The problem comes when we're confronted with an environment that we don't know how we're going to handle it until we're confronted with that, either circumstance or environment. And that's the problem with war. And I think if we boil it down not only to war, that's the problem with sin and the problem with one of the commandments, namely, thou shalt not kill, namely, getting down to one person killing another person, namely, getting down to specifics, who dies if one person is in struggle with another person, does then party A give up and let party B kill him, or does party A try and defend the life to which we feel is so precious? And I think that ultimately, you know, as a Christian, I really have a strong desire to live, and I also have a strong desire to follow the way of Christ. But I don't know. Which is going to be stronger if you and I should come into conflict?
Okay, and I know there's somebody else. Do you have some sense of Scripture giving any clue as to which should be stronger? Your desire to follow Christ or your desire to live?
Well, Christ definitely laid down his life, didn't he?
Did he say anything to us about which of those two should be the stronger?
Yes, I know which two should be the stronger, but in my own human frailty, okay, I find it hard to lay down my life.
To me, my hermeneutic in this situation is a bit different, I think, from John. I don't see the New Testament as giving us that clear a picture of just exactly how we as Christians are supposed to make our decisions and live our lives. I think the cross means that each one of our decisions, day-to-day decisions, as well as the big things in which we're in discussion tonight, we must realize that we're not going to really know what is right. I think Christ went through his life really baffled at times. I know the disciples did, and I know I am, on decisions from day to day. What is God's will in my life? And, you know, this big question is the same thing. It's much more difficult, perhaps, but the same type of problem for a Christian, that we are not going to really know. For example, somebody may be a good Christian and be a vote Democrat. Somebody may be a good Christian and actually vote Republican. I just had to say that. Pardon me, I just joked. You know, but we have to come out as friends and as two Christian brothers and sisters. Now that's a little easier to talk about than what we're involved in right now, but to me it's the same thing. There are going to be some decisions like that where we're going to have to go to war at, Some people will be able to go to war over a particular, whatever's happening, situation. Other people may not be able to. Other Christians may not be able to. But I think that's the hard stuff of the cross, that we are actually being crucified day to day in our decisions that we have to make as Christian people and following the way. And any time we set up the way, the simplistic the way, I think we've got some problems. Dan?
You know, I really don't understand that. I don't think Jesus has left us with any option on that night. I'm uncomfortable with you saying simplistic. We have an option to vote Republican or Democrat, but I don't, the option of being violent or nonviolent, that decision is already made.
I didn't talk about nonviolent or violent. I talked about going to war with the issue of here and being a soldier and I. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about violence or nonviolence.
I don't understand.
Nonviolent war. I'm not talking about that particular issue of violence or nonviolence. I'm talking about something. I think what the forum is about is having a military, isn't that correct?
But how can we separate military from violence?
Do you pay taxes? Do you withhold your taxes for military spending?
Thank you, Bob.
But you don't now?
No.
Okay, that's all I have to know.
Sounds like a lawyer.
Yes.
There certainly is a white knuckle section. I find myself pulled one direction and then another direction by the discussion. And I hear it being said or implied that there are good wars and then there are bad wars. At least it's an impression that I've received. There are no good wars. I don't think there's any war in history that has been defined a good war. I, as a Christian, am constantly faced with decisions. I was asked recently, are you a good Christian? And I said, I like to think myself a good Christian, but I find myself going to communion knowing that I have made poor decisions, I have sinned, and I'm humbly asking God for his forgiveness. And these types of decisions can reach down to whether I, as an individual, will accept a part in a war. I accepted a part in a war, knowing that it's wrong, but knowing that I can come to Christ and to God and ask for his forgiveness for that decision. That I know to be true. That I feel, that I know to be true. I don't feel it to be true. I know it to be true. For somebody else, that may not be the way that they feel. I was in France in 19... What the heck was the year that the European War ended?
45.
I had just been reassigned and issued orders to go east and take part in the Japanese event. Boom, the war ended. I was relieved. Perhaps not the thousands of people in Japan, they were not relieved, they were dead. But I was relieved. Now I felt a sense of relief, but I felt a sense of sorrow also for those people. I'm not sure what the discussion is around this room, but for me, it is a decision that I have to make. I can make it, and I will answer to God at a point in time. That's how I feel. That's how I see this discussion going. For the young people in the balcony, they have a decision to make. I have two 20-year-olds that registered last week. I have a different feeling for them. Now, we can talk about Christ and how he felt and what he planned for us. But it comes down to that point in the future when I meet God face to face and I say, forgive me. And I have the assurance that he will.
Yeah. First, I have to clarify something before a telegram goes to Luther.
that I'm not concerned about. I hope I meant today. I don't see the early church as the purest form of Christianity just because it's closest to Christ. But I do think it's important to learn from it in a hermeneutical sense. And then I just want to maybe throw out an idea, and it doesn't necessarily have to respond to, but is there some way that we can see fighting a war as a servant act, in that we are serving the world in fighting a war for the cause of justice?
I don't think that fits the biblical definition of a servant, because the way I understand the role of the servant in both the Old and the New Testament, the servant is one who willingly suffers. And
well, that'll be something.
No, but without retaliating against those inflicting the suffering. Now, the moment the person in pain or suffering retaliates, that I feel strongly, as this gentleman here, that may be a decision that I might make in a moment of threat or something, but I believe that would be a sin, and I believe that God would forgive me for it, but I believe that would not be a servant act. And because the real image of the servant is ultimately Christ, who as the servant willingly was nailed to that cross. And I don't see any way in which if Christ had struck back at his crucifiers, we wouldn't have the image of the servant. It wouldn't be that anymore.
But the servant said, "Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me?"
Yeah, that's the sign of the ultimate despair, right, into which the despair of that suffering which Christ shared as fully human. But that doesn't, even then, that didn't justify some kind of retaliation against those who inflicted that.
Does for me.
Can we be a Christian and not be a follower of the way?
Well, historically, the two things are the same thing. I mean, but are we
truly little Christ, or are we not? Don't we always, as Gordon said, aren't we constantly under grace? And don't we constantly need, not just over the issue of war, of over every thought and desire, and aren't we totally dependent on him in our sinful state, regardless of what it is? Even in peace, we're not really little Christ. We aren't really sinless in anything we do.
But if you carry that one further step, you see that Christ has died for me. Christ has also died for that communist. Christ has died for that German. That in fact, for a Christian, there are no enemies. Mm-hmm. And that undergirds everything that we have to do. The forgiveness that absorbs hostility, the servanthood that replaces domination, starts from the point that in Christ, we are one. And that the way that we live our lives should reflect that unity and not the hostility, not American versus Russia, but we are one in Christ.
I wish I could convince the Russians of that so they wouldn't build their armaments.
Can I speak to that? Because I think the place, if I was misunderstood at any point, and I probably was misunderstood at a lot of them, it was that somehow we could perfectly follow the way. Not saying that. I'm saying my understanding of the Christian part of this, or followers of the way, is to have Christ as the highest authority in my life. And that I'm seeking to do. I need a Christ who forgives me for my mistakes. I feel I could say, you and I are brothers. All right. The other side of that
the Christ who forgives me, I also continue to say Jesus is my Lord. So if he can direct my life, I want not only to be forgiven when I miss, I want him to be the Lord of my life, meaning that's my highest authority. My understanding, and you know, that's what a forum's all about. I've said that three times. My understanding is he calls me to a kind of faithfulness that has me live away even if the Russians do not disarm. Yes, I'm saying that. I think that's the scandal of the cross. I won't do that perfectly, but I do want to be able to say Jesus is my Lord and my Savior, and I am eternally grateful for his grace. I also want the confrontation and the lordship or the kingship of Christ to be the highest authority in my life. And I think that's what the forum, I think you're right, that's what the forum is all about.
I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
I wanted to follow up a point that was made by Joel just a minute ago, talking about that Mennonite background. He characterized their response as, well, God will take care of it. I'm really wary of that kind of justification of a pacifist position, because you could apply that then to all kinds of things. There's hunger in the world, well, God will take care of it. It's all in God's plan. God is the Lord of history. What I like about John Howard Yoder's explication of that tradition is that it isn't an all or nothing thing. It isn't you either espouse war and all of its trappings or God will take care of it. Yoder has an understanding of Jesus' own life and ministry in the politics of Jesus that makes it clear that although Jesus espoused a nonviolent way, it was anything but a stand back and let it all happen to you. Jesus took the battle to them in a sense. Maybe I should use a military image there. in a sense, it's that. It seems to me we live in a world in which the only option for doing something about the great issues that face us is not a military option. The only option for dealing with the enmity between Russia and the United States is not to escalate the arms race until we blow each other off the face of the map. There are all kinds of other options open to us that we ought to actively and vigorously work at that are consistent with the way. It seems to me that as Christians, before we resort to the military option at any point, we would have to almost be in Bonhoeffer's position. We would have to say that absolutely every other remedy that could be conceived of has been exhausted in dealing with this problem, and then take that step only acknowledging it as a sinful one. And I might be willing to make that step under certain circumstances. I don't think, I'm not clear in my own mind whether I can espouse an absolutely pacifist position. But I am clear that the only circumstances in which I could take that step would be when I'm convinced there are no others and yet and would take it only acknowledging it to be a sinful one when I did.
I think I ought to suggest that we close now for those who want to leave. Give those who want to leave a chance to leave, realizing that tomorrow night's topic is very close to this one, and I think some of the questions and concerns you might want to voice now, you can voice then without being off the topic much. And those of you who want to stay and continue to talk, welcome to do that too. So thank you all.